Welcome to the PRI Review, brought to you by the Population Research Institute. I'm your host, Christopher Mannion. What can be done to reverse this ominous trend? The U.S. fertility rate hits a new record low. The last year of the Obama administration saw the fertility rate fall to an all-time low. According to recent data from the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics, the U.S. fertility rate sank to a record low of 62 births per 1,000 women of reproductive age in 2016. This was a slight decrease from the 2015 fertility rate, which stood at 62.5. The downward trend is not showing signs of stopping either. According to NCHS preliminary estimates, fertility slumped even lower to 61.5 in the first quarter of 2017. The U.S. birth rate, a slightly different measure of fertility, also fell among younger women 15 to 29 years of age. A small increase in births among women 30 years of age and older was not enough to make up for the decline among younger women. The Great Depression led to a staggering drop in fertility rates. The current fertility decline is similarly driven by the still lingering effects of the Great Recession of 2007. Studies have shown that unemployment and employment uncertainty adversely affect the birth rate overall and lead young people to postpone marriage. Both male and female unemployment affect fertility, though the effect remains stronger for male unemployment. Fertility is also more likely to decline in developed countries when domestic product contracts. A decline in the birth rate has also been found to be linked with other economic indicators such as per capita GDP, per capita income, the number of first-time unemployment claims, and consumer confidence. The Great Recession has fallen particularly hard on young adults who play a major role in contributing to the overall fertility rate. Following the 2007 to 2016 Great Recession, which is more accurately referred to as the Great Depression number two, many young adults have struggled to enter the workforce to find affordable housing and to accumulate wealth. Prerequisites necessary in contemporary American society for partnership and family formation. The Great Recession has also fallen particularly hard on Hispanics, a demographic that, for the past few decades, has helped boost the fertility rate in the United States. Non-Hispanic black and non-Hispanic white women have seen a modest decrease in fertility by 7.3 and 1.7 births per 1,000 women of reproductive age from 2007 to 2015, respectively. Hispanic women have seen a precipitous decline of 25.7 births per 1,000 women over the same period. According to NCHS, the total fertility rate in the U.S. in 2015 was 1.84. This rate sits below the replacement fertility rate, the rate of births necessary for population replacement. According to the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs, replacement fertility in the United States is estimated to average 2.07 from 2015 to 2020. If birth rates continue to decline and immigration drops off, the impact on the U.S. economy could be significant. Population growth, or more specifically, an increase in the labor force, is a key determinant of economic growth. Economists estimate that as much as one-third of economic growth is attributable to workers being added to the labor force every year. Low birth rates correspond to aging population. The U.S. is facing a substantial increase in its dependency ratio as the baby boomers retire, and working-age adults must replace the productivity thus lost and pay for the entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare. To maintain productivity, one solution is to work longer hours or to postpone retirement. But given there are only so many hours in a day and so many additional years the elderly can be expected to work, there is only so much lost productivity that can be compensated for in this way. Barring a major technological breakthrough to boost productivity and efficiency, demographic decline will almost certainly have a net drag effect on the economy. Will birth rates rebound? As the Great Recession recedes into memory, and as the Trump economic policies stimulate growth, birth rates will likely increase again. They did, after all, following the Great Depression. But the demographic recovery this time around is unlikely to be nearly so robust as it was during the baby boom. American society has changed. Fertility rates are unlikely to reach formal levels because fertility goals desired in the United States overall have declined. In recent decades, however, women have increasingly opted to postpone childbearing. The shift has been so consistent across the U.S. that the birth rate for women in the 30 to 34 age group has now surpassed the 20 to 24 age group. There are far fewer teenage brides than in years past, and more young women are choosing college over childbearing. A more educated population is, of course, vital to continued economic growth, but so is a healthy birth rate. Are young couples merely postponing childbearing until they are older and have completed their education? Or are they foregoing it altogether? It may be too soon to tell which way fertility will trend post-Great Recession. While many couples initially seem to merely postpone having children, as when the downturn hit, recent fertility data seems to indicate that, as the Obama recession dragged on year after year, many ultimately revised their fertility goals downward. Couples who postpone births have generally yet to make up for the loss, proving once again that fertility delayed is fertility denied. The solution, in our opinion, is an expansion of the Child Tax Credit, the CTC. Senator Marco Rubio has long advocated increasing the maximum credit from $1,000 to $2,500, as well as making it fully refundable. A fully refundable CTC would reduce taxes of working families across the board. This, in turn, would be a powerful inducement for them to have another child. After all, children are the only future of a family or a nation. That's the weekly briefing from the Population Research Institute at pop.org. We'll be right back. Do you want to win pro-life legislative and political battles? For years, PRI has been helping pro-life leaders on the ground around the world to win legislative and political battles in order to protect the lives of the unborn. And now we're asking for your help so we can continue this vital work. Let me tell you more. In a number of countries around the world, there are still pro-life laws on the books. But the Planned Parenthood Abortion Über Alles Malthusians are out there to get rid of those laws. Nearly 5 years ago, the Pontifical Council on the Family asked PRI to be the main organization to help the pro-life movements around the world to be more effective. In response to the Vatican's request, we created our Pro-Life Victory Seminars and our Pro-Life Strategy Guide. The seminars are grueling, demanding 12 to 14-hour intense working sessions. Only the most proven and successful leaders are invited to speak. Only the best and the most committed activists are invited to attend. To date, we have conducted 60 such sessions in 18 countries. We have trained more than 1,700 people who are serious about protecting the unborn in their respective countries. They have won some victories, but I'm not going to tell you about those because I don't want to put a target on the back of those leaders. I'm not going to tell you the names of their countries either because I don't want to make it even harder for them to do their work. But here's a hint. Most, though not all, have Spanish as their native tongue. It's no secret that south of our border, pro-abortionists are zeroing in on the existing pro-life laws in that part of the world. I cannot tell you the battle stories, although there are many, without endangering the victories of the leaders. I must ask you to take my word that some battles in some countries could not have been won without the training and support received from PRI. What kind of training am I talking about? Everywhere in the world, defenders of life need everything. Strategic thinking skills, campaign skills, legislative skills, lobbying skills to protect their pro-life laws and to stop pro-death initiatives. Around the world, we found that the biggest thing lacking is know-how. By that, I mean political sophistication. Here in America, we've been fighting pro-life battles for almost 50 years, and while we haven't won definitively, we have learned a lot about how to fight, as well as how not to fight. One of the most important tools of our pro-life victory training is the manual that the trainees get to take home with them. The Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles. Think of it as a field guide to activism. The guide is a compendium of know-how. It is 200 pages of distilled experience and wisdom, with step-by-step instructions about how to advance our issue in a representative landscape. Here's a small sampling of the know-how delivered in these training sessions. How to raise money. How to lobby legislators, how to write powerful pro-life advertising, how to effectively appear on TV and radio, how to enlist volunteers, how to get out the vote, and how to successfully debate pro-abortionists. All this and much, much more is covered in the training program and reinforced in the training guide. The first edition came out in 2012, but we are all out of them now. They have all been put in the hands of able pro-life leaders. So today we have had it revised and updated by two of the best and most successful activists in the Spanish-speaking world. Today the new PRI, Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles, is ready to go to press. This is where you come in. Will you help us get it into the hands of the people who need it? It's in Spanish right now, and that's as it should be, because we distribute it throughout the Spanish-speaking world. The Vatican wants this field manual in every diocese in the world. Will you help me to fulfill that request? PRI has ordered 10,000 copies of the guide to be printed, enough for every student who will attend our training sessions for the next several years, along with all the actively pro-life bishops around the world. Just the printing alone will cost $50,000. The whole International Victory Training Program costs another $50,000, and that is in addition to the field guide. But right now we want to get those guides printed. So I turn to you because I know you understand its value. The cost comes out to about $5 per book, which is not very much considering the impact it can have and the lives it can save. With your tax-deductible gift of $50, PRI can put this guide into the hands of 10 in-country pro-life leaders. With a gift of $100, we can make sure that 10 friendly bishops get a copy to guide their strategic thinking in the protection of life. No gift is too small. If you can only spare $5, please send it today. Unborn babies around the world will be safer because of your sacrifice today. Can we count on you to help PRI to continue to train and empower the pro-life movement around the world? On behalf of all those fighting to preserve pro-life laws around the world, thank you. Here's the latest weekly briefing from the Population Research Institute. Pro-family voices defend rights of the family at the Organization of American States. This past June 19th, PRI's Sergio Burga Alvarez delivered an address before the ambassadors at the 47th regular session of the Organization of American States, known as the OAS, in Cancun, Mexico. Señor Burga, representing the Coalition of Democracy and Human Rights, expressed the sentiment of 670 parliamentarians from various Latin American countries and called on the OAS to abide by the terms and limits of its mandate and to cease promoting gender ideology on sovereign member states. We ask that the OAS cease their intention to impose an agenda that promotes an ideology that has nothing to do with the will of the people, but on the contrary, subtracts from the authority of their legitimately elected representatives, Burga said. Pro-family member states in the OAS General Assembly subsequently successfully blocked attempts to incorporate language condemning so-called homophobia and transphobia, and attempts to include for the first time the term intersex in the session's outcome resolution. Because OAS member states have not defined the terms homophobia, transphobia, or intersex, observers believe that inclusion of these terms in an OAS resolution would have been interpreted broadly and expansively by pro-LGBT countries like Canada and the United States, and could have been used in the future in attempts to pressure Latin American countries to legalize so-called safe-sex marriage. The OAS is the world's oldest regional intergovernmental institution. Its precursor, the International Union of American Republics, predates both the League of Nations and the United Nations. The OAS was established to ensure peace and security, democracy, national sovereignty, solidarity between nations, social justice, and fundamental rights throughout the Americas. Every sovereign country in the Western Hemisphere, with the exception of Cuba, is a member of the OAS and bound by its charter. The OAS charter guarantees member states the right to political independence, self-defense, and territorial integrity in accordance with international law. A majority of OAS member states has also ratified the American Convention on Human Rights. Article 4 of the convention explicitly protects the right to life in general from the moment of conception. Article 17 of the convention furthermore protects the rights of the family as the natural and fundamental unit of society and is entitled to protection by society and the state. The OAS is bound to respect the convention for states that have ratified it. Despite the guarantee for the independence of states in the OAS charter and the rights secured by the American Convention on Human Rights, the OAS at the highest levels has routinely pushed for the legalization of abortion and the acceptance of gender ideology in member states. OAS Secretary General Luis Almagro has made it clear that he believes Latin American countries ought to legalize abortion. Almagro believes the legalization of abortion is not simply one among many issues, but rather a priority that ought to take precedence over key economic and development goals such as reducing unemployment. The Americas continue to have some of the most restrictive laws regarding sexual and reproductive rights and freedoms, and that reality has to change, Almagro said in an address delivered at the 2015 UN Women's Conference of Global Leaders on Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment, a commitment to action. First, we have to fix this kind of genocide, that is, the failure to legalize abortion. Then we can deal with other matters, such as why women are the poorest, the most unemployed, why their salaries are the lowest, why we need to increase women's political participation, end quote. The OAS has advocated strongly for the acceptance of gender ideology throughout Latin America, particularly through the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, an organization of the OAS responsible for promoting human rights in the Americas. The IACHR, as it's known, ensures that member states respect rights protected by the American Convention on Human Rights and the American Declaration of the Rights and Duties of Man. Earlier this year, the IACHR called upon all OAS member states to normalize and promote transgenderism, advocating for its acceptance through the force of law. IACHR has asked member states to adopt urgent measures to mainstream a gender identity approach into public policies. The states of the region have a commitment to adjust their legal frameworks so that we have an Americas that leaves cisnormality behind. That means normality, folks. IACHR President Francisco Eguiguren Praeli publicly remarked on the occasion of Trans Day of Visibility, whatever that is, by asking American nations to leave cisnormality behind, Praeli has called upon independent states to reject the integrity of male and female, motherhood and fatherhood, and the natural complementarity inherent and evident in human nature. It is within this context that PRI's Sergio Burga Alvarez addressed ambassadors at the 47th regular session of the OAS. Excerpts from his speech are translated as follows. Honorable ambassadors, representatives of the independent member states, Honorable Mr. Secretary General, we would like to thank you for this opportunity to be able to express the view shared by millions of people who do not have the opportunity to present in this forum, but who have worked together for years to defend our values and the disadvantaged. We want to take this opportunity to express our deep concern for what has recently been taking place at the OAS, specifically some of the actions taken by members of the organs, that's the bureaucracy, that make up the OAS. Those are including the Inter-American Commission of Women, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. Their actions have not only violated rights established in the American Convention on Human Rights, but also overstepped the mandate that has been given to them by the member states of the OAS. We view with concern that non-binding resolutions continue to include language and create supposed rights when these are not agreed to by our states through treaties which are actually binding. Subsequently, these resolutions are later used to pressure the countries into accepting this new language. For example, the CIDH has incorporated the terms sexual orientation and gender identity that have not been accepted, nor have they been defined by the nations. The CIDH took these so-called terms from the Yogyakarta Principles, a document produced by a group of private individuals with special interests, which is not binding on states. Furthermore, they have gone so far, in this instance, as to add a new category not previously agreed to, so-called intersex. Not intersection, intersex. Now, none of these terms are found in international treaties ratified by the nations. Moreover, the agency continues to delegate the authority to supposed experts, commissioners, and judges, not to interpret but rather reinterpret the treaties, changing completely the intent of such treaties by the states. We are not able to speak about democracy when the OAS is not capable of respecting the will of the people through their legitimately elected representatives, that is to say, their parliamentarians. Too often, the Commission of Human Rights and the other organs, even the Secretary General, have exceeded the mandates of their offices and have overstepped the bounds of the agreements and mandates granted to them by the states. These excesses threaten the democratic process, the will of the people, and the rule of law, typical bureaucracies. At the same time, we want to take this opportunity to call upon the honorable ambassadors, who are our voice before this organization. We want to remind you that your duty is with your citizens and with the law of the states that you represent. It is your duty to respect the will expressed in the international treaties that have been signed and ratified. In other words, validated by the legitimate representatives of the people and not by authorities that do not understand the internal reality of nations and that have not been chosen by us to decide. It is for this reason that we support and applaud the Declaration of Mexico, presented in Mexico City this past June 15th, in which more than 670 lawmakers from all over the region participated. The Declaration of Mexico calls upon the OAS and its institutions to stop imposing gender ideology on us and to once again begin abiding by the legal framework that has been given to them. The OAS's actions undermine the authority that has been legitimately conferred upon them as elected representatives of their people. To conclude, we ask those in leadership positions at OAS to respect the legal framework under which they were legitimately authorized to act. Otherwise, it is urgent that mechanisms for transparency and accountability be strengthened. Failure to secure transparency and accountability would necessarily and negatively affect the credibility of the OAS, failing to respect the principles on which it was founded: democracy, security, human rights, and development. It is necessary that the OAS work harder to strengthen the democratic process and to intervene in cases where the most fundamental rights of the human person are violated, such as poverty, hunger, violence, lack of access to medicine, and so on. This is the case with our brothers and sisters in Venezuela who are suffering due to the absence of political freedom and the correct application of the principles for which the OAS was created. We ask that the OAS cease their intention to impose an agenda that promotes an ideology that has nothing to do with the will of the people, but on the contrary subtracts from the authority of their legitimately elected representatives. And to our ambassadors, we call upon them to be brave and to defend the voice of their people. By now, we all know that Planned Parenthood is accused in the United States of allegedly violating the law by, among other atrocities, selling baby body parts. But what you might not realize is that Planned Parenthood's affiliates, Planned Parenthood Federation of America, PPFA, and International Planned Parenthood Federation, IPPF, are still getting away with murder overseas. Around the world, and especially in Latin America, the baby-killing giant shades the truth about its abortion-related activities. It runs roughshod over local anti-abortion laws and violates local pro-life sentiment, all with seeming impunity. But not anymore. With your tax-deductible gift, PRI will throw the book at the abortion giants overseas, just as pro-life groups are doing here at home. Did you know that PPFA spends about $38 million a year lobbying to legalize abortion in countries around the world? If they're successful, they can kill as many, if not more, babies overseas as they do in the United States. But there's a hitch. Because abortion remains illegal in most Latin American countries, neither IPPF nor PPFA is eligible for government funding for abortion-related activities as they are in the United States. So PPFA, IPPF, gets around it as only they know how to do, by lying. With a wink and a nod, they disguise the programs they are funding as, quote, education or health programs, women's right, human rights protection or promotion, and anti-discrimination initiatives aimed at protecting vulnerable groups such as women or LGBTs, that means lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, end quote. Catholic bishops throughout Africa and Latin America complain about this. They call it ideological imperialism, but their voices are not heard in Congress because America's bishops depend on billions in government funding for their own charities. They don't want to bite the political hand that feeds them. Now, PRI receives no government funding, so we aren't hampered by golden handcuffs. That's why your tax-deductible gift to PRI is so important today. As the lead group investigating Planned Parenthood's activities overseas, PRI's Latin American office has uncovered PPFA's thinly disguised efforts to undermine pro-life laws and legitimate abortion on demand. But we've only found the tip of the iceberg, and there is more work to be done, work that we can't do alone. Your tax-deductible gift will help PRI hire a seasoned pro-life legal team to help us expose, investigate, and prosecute Planned Parenthood's affiliates everywhere they prey on women, especially overseas. Together, we'll expose, investigate, and prosecute PPFA and IPPF everywhere it tries to hide the truth. This two-prong attack, complementing the hearings taking place in Washington, will force Planned Parenthood to fight on two fronts. What better way to strike a blow against the real Planned Parenthood, the one we saw in all those horrific videos, than to come at them here and abroad? So please make a tax-deductible gift to support this and all of PRI's baby-saving efforts around the world. Yes, they're powerful. Yes, they're big. But remember, David and Goliath. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. A federal district judge has ruled that a series of Indiana laws banning sex-selective abortion and other discriminatory forms of abortion are unconstitutional. Last Friday, Southern District Court of Indiana Judge Tanya Walton Pratt, appointed to the federal bench in 2010 by Barack Obama, placed a permanent injunction on several pro-life state laws. Pratt's ruling overturns a number of provisions in the Indiana Code, banning sex-selective abortion, terminations targeting the unborn, diagnosed with Down syndrome and other disabilities, and abortions performed on the sole basis of the child's race, color, or ancestry. Judge Pratt further nullified a provision requiring abortion centers to humanely inter or cremate the remains of aborted babies. Pratt opined that giving aborted babies the dignity of burial or cremation was not, open quote, a legitimate state interest, close quote. Now, the good people of Indiana, through their elected representatives, had democratically decided to protect the dignity of aborted infants, as Population Research Institute President Stephen Mosier. The state has an interest in upholding the dignity of human life even after death. That's why we generally bury our dead, Mosier says. This is a textbook example of judicial overreach. The provisions struck down by Pratt were part of a landmark pro-life bill passed by the Indiana General Assembly and signed into law in March of 2016 by current U.S. Vice President Mike Pence, who at the time was governor of Indiana. The American Civil Liberties Union, on behalf of Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky, sued the state of Indiana in federal court shortly after the HEA 1337 became law. The court placed a temporary injunction on the law on June 30th of last year, the day before the law was set to take effect. Friday's ruling makes the injunction permanent and marks a major win for Planned Parenthood and pro-abortion activists. Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill has said that he plans to appeal the case to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. According to Hill, the court's jurisdiction to overturn HEA 1337's prohibition of disability, color, and race-selective abortion clears the path for genetic discrimination that once seemed like science fiction, according to a statement by Hill quoted in the Chicago Tribune. Judge Pratt's ruling will also remove essential legal provisions protecting the right to life for unborn children diagnosed with congenital disabilities such as Down syndrome, allowing for selective termination procedures of the disabled to continue. If the ruling is allowed to stand, it would represent the first time a federal court has thrown out a law prohibiting sex-selective abortion after viability. Obama's appointees to the federal courts have consistently advocated a radical pro-abortion agenda that has little to do with the Constitution, but accurately reflects the current official position of the Democrat Party that requires officials, including appointees to the courts, to advocate so-called abortion rights. They are no longer allowed to be neutral. And, of course, they've never been allowed to be pro-life. In 1993, a federal court partially blocked a similar sex selective abortion law in Illinois, ruling that banning the practice before viability was unconstitutional, but that the prohibition could still constitutionally apply to post-viability unborn infants. Although the Indiana sex selective abortion law contained a severability clause, Judge Pratt elected to throw out the law entirely, striking the Indiana sex selective abortion ban even after the point of viability. According to the pro-abortion Guttmacher Institute, 10 states currently have laws in place banning sex selective abortion. A sex selective abortion law passed in the state of Arkansas earlier this year has been placed on a temporary injunction and is awaiting a final ruling. As the Supreme Court ruled in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, one of the essential holdings of Roe v. Wade is that states cannot outlaw abortion prior to viability. However, even if states are not able to ban abortion entirely, states are able to regulate abortion prior to viability. The court in Planned Parenthood v. Casey also determined that the state has legitimate interests from the outset of the pregnancy in protecting the health of the woman and the life of the fetus. Prior to Casey, courts were required to subject laws in defense of life to strict scrutiny, the most rigorous legal test that courts can apply to legislation. After Casey, however, it became necessary only to prove that regulations on abortion did not constitute an undue burden to women's access to abortion, a less restrictive test than strict scrutiny. Most Americans are supportive of legal bans on sex-selective abortion, as the practice is relatively uncommon and widely perceived across the political spectrum as reprehensible, discriminatory, and harmful for women's health and well-being. It is difficult to imagine how banning sex-selective abortion would constitute an undue burden. While relatively uncommon, sex-selective abortion continues to be practiced in the United States. Women in some migrant communities in the U.S. are forced to bear the brunt of culturally backward attitudes, sometimes being coerced or physically abused, unless they abort their unborn daughters. Several years ago, Sunita Puri and others interviewed a number of women with past experiences with sex-selective abortion in the U.S. As one woman's account illustrates, women have little to say or protection from the law when oppressed by a strong son preference attitudes. And I quote, "My husband heard about ultrasounds from a friend, and we have come here now to find out if we are having a son. If not, I will have to get an abortion because he does not want another daughter." Prohibition of sex-selective abortion in the United States would not only protect the lives of girls, but would also support, through law, the equal dignity and status of women. A legal ban would make it more difficult for family members to pressure women into aborting their daughters. It would remove the threat of lawsuits physicians can face when attempting to help women who may feel undue pressure from family members to go through with a sex-selective abortion. Furthermore, law is a teacher, and a legal ban would advance the protection of the equal rights of women. The state has a legitimate interest in protecting the rights and the health of women and girls. Protecting the right to life and the right to exist are the most fundamental of all human rights. And I'm quoting here from Stephen Mosier, PRI president. "Because of this ill-considered decision of the court, babies, little girls, and the handicapped will continue to be condemned to death by the worst form of discrimination imaginable. It's discrimination that kills." That's our latest weekly briefing from the Population Research Institute at pop.org. Thanks for listening.